All right. Morning, Saints.
Morning, Brandon.
Here we are again. If you've got your Bibles, open up to 1 Kings, and we're going to carry on with our study in the life of Elijah. So 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings chapter 17. Last time that we met and looked at some thoughts in the life of Elijah, we looked at how the brook had dried up, so God sent him to the widow of Zarephath. And Zarephath means smelting furnace. And we looked at how God had provided this widow there to actually make provision for the two of them, you know, and she was willing to give of the little, really, that she had. And every time they went to the barrel of flour and the barrel of oil, there was always enough for the day. And we saw how God chose this woman who actually had an empty barrel to actually make provision for her son and for Elijah. And it says that the bin of flour was not used up, nor did the jar of oil run dry, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Elijah. So these guys, even though there was a time of famine, God's miraculous power, he kept them with what they needed continually. And it actually never ran out. And it was never exhausted. It never overflowed. But every time they went there, it was always enough. So the next little passage goes from verse 17 down to 24, and the scene changes. So we'll just read it. Now it happened after these things that the son of the woman who owned the house became sick, and his sickness was so serious that there was no breath left in him. So she said to Elijah, "What have I to do with you, O man of God? Have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to kill my son?" And he said to her, "Give me your son." So he took him out of her arms and carried him up to the upper room where he was staying, and he laid him on his own bed. And then he cried out to the Lord and said, "O Lord my God, have you also brought tragedy on the widow with whom I lodged by killing her son?" And he stretched himself out on the child three times and cried out to the Lord and said, "O Lord my God, I pray, let this child's soul come back to him." And then the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came back to him, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And then the woman said to Elijah, "Now by this I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is the truth." So you've got a very different scene to the one that's just been. They've got Elijah and this widow and her son, actually in a time of famine, are actually doing okay. The house is pleasant. Every time they go to get a meal, they can dip their hand in the barrel and there's something there. And this goes on, it doesn't say how long this goes on for, but at some point the scene changes and sickness enters into the house. And the name of this place means smelting furnace. And this woman is now going to undergo some sort of heat or some sort of trial or some sort of pressure upon her, because not only has she lost a husband, but now she's actually going to lose a son. And in verse 18, she says to Elijah, "What have I to do with you, O man of God? Have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to kill my son?" In other words, what she's saying is, if you weren't here, Elijah, none of this would actually have happened. And indirectly she's blaming Elijah, indirectly she's blaming God, but more than that, she's actually saying, "It's actually my fault. It's my sin that has been brought to remembrance. It's my sin that has actually caused my son to die." And when I read this, I thought, it's an interesting thought, because when's the last time tragedy or something really wrong has come into your existence or into your family life or into something like that? How often do you look at it? Is this judgment from God? Is this because of Is this something that I have done that has actually brought this to pass? Is it because of my sin that this has happened? Does anyone actually ever think that? When things go wrong, do you actually look at your own lives and think, this could be so because of my own sin? But is that true? It could be. Sometimes there is judgments because of, or consequences because of sin. Discipline, there's discipline of the Father, but not all the time. You know? It doesn't, just because something goes wrong doesn't mean that it's something that you've done. But it can be, you know? Like, you remember when Jesus, he came across the person that was born blind, and his disciples came to him and said, look, why is this person born blind? Is it his own sin, or is it his parents? Was it something that his parents had done that has caused this person to be born blind? Or is it something that he did, I don't know how, to be born blind? But something in the womb, he did something, kicked it wrong. Yeah. But Jesus said neither. Because sin, in this instance, sin isn't the issue. But the glory of God may be shown in this man's healing. But yeah, in some cases, there's consequences to the wrong things that we do, or God can discipline us, but it's not all the time, because tragedy and illness and sickness and just bad stuff happens to the righteous and the unrighteous. It happens to all. And this woman, her first sort of response is, it's actually because of me. It doesn't say what that sin is that she had been brought to remembrance about. But somehow she was saying, something I have done has actually caused this. It's because of me. When I was thinking about that, I thought, you know, like, when they're in the house and they've got plentiful, they've got abundance, sometimes when everything is going right for us, there's no real acknowledgement of sin in our lives. Sometimes it actually takes a tragedy, a sickness, an illness, something, a trial, something that goes wrong to actually bring out the state of our hearts. Sometimes the grounds of our hearts are very hidden from us. But sometimes when things go all wrong, you can actually start to examine your own heart and your own life, and you see that those grounds aren't that clean as you may think. But when everything's going fine, you actually, most of the time, you're not conscious of the wrongs that are within. But a little bit of pressure and a little bit of hardship that comes our way, sometimes our consciousness is awakened. And we can see things, yes, things are not all good. Things are not all right. And I think it was this for this woman. So God actually uses all of these tragedies and all of these hard things to actually awaken things that can sometimes be hidden. And this woman, instantly she says, why have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to kill my son? And then he said to her, this is Elijah, give me your son. So he doesn't actually go into the argument here, he just takes the son off her. And she took him up out of her arms and carried him to the upper room where he was staying and laid him on his own bed. And he cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord my God, have you also brought tragedy on the widow by whom I lodged by killing her son? So Elijah also is saying to God, you're actually responsible for this, or responsible for me being here, that this has happened. And he stretched himself out on the child three times and cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord my God, I pray, let this child's soul come back to him. And then the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came back to him, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house, and he gave him to his mother. And he said, see, your son lives. This is the first miracle of resurrection in the Old Testament. Does anyone know how many miracles of resurrection there are in the Old Testament? Who was resurrected? obviously the widow's son. Who else? Yep. Yeah, in New Testament, in Old Testament.
Oh,
yeah, there's three. There's a real obscure one. All right. The first one was this widow's son by Elijah. The second one was the child by Elisha. You know how Elisha prayed for a double portion? You see that in the miracles when you contrast the two. Elijah performed one miracle of resurrection. Elisha does too. The first one was the child by Elisha. And the next one is a real obscure one where after Elisha is actually buried, they go to bury this guy and there's a band of raiders that are coming to get them. So they bury this body really quickly and they actually put it into Elisha's grave. And when this man touches Elisha's bones, he actually comes to life again. Don't ask me what that one is all about. But it's in 2 Kings. Yeah, have a hunt out later. Yeah, so when this man's dead and they bury him, have to bury him quickly because there's raiders coming to get them. So they chuck him into the grave of Elisha, and when he hits his bones, he actually comes alive again. So you got three miracles of resurrection in the Old Testament, and you got three miracles of resurrection with Christ. The first one is just like a widow's son was killed here with Elijah. You got the woman of Nain in Luke chapter 7. Awesome passage. You know, you see Jesus, the crowd's all around him and he's walking along the roadside. And this woman of Nain, she's a widow, her only son, they carry him out on an open stretcher or an open coffin and they're on their way to bury him. And Jesus actually stops the procession and he tells the boy to get up. And he sits up out of the coffin and speaks to the crowd and comes down. It's an amazing miracle. I remember that, who's that crowd that work in Amsterdam? I think it's the Steiner, No Longer Music. They used to use this one as an evangelistic tool all the time. They would go into the city and reenact this. They'd take a coffin on their shoulders and a guy in it, and they'd walk down the street and everyone would be mourning, and then they'd stop in the open square and a guy would jump out and preach the gospel. But they used to use that, yeah. So you got that one, the widow's son, the woman of Nain. The next one was Jairus' daughter. And does anyone know the third one? Lazarus. Well, yeah, he's the fourth.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. The biggie. Yeah. So just, you had a widow's son, you had a child, and you also had a man. In the New Testament, you got the same. You got a widow's son, you got a child, and you've got a man, Lazarus. And Lazarus is a whole one in itself, you know, that Christ would, Jesus knew that he was sick and he deliberately stayed away, you know, two more days. And then he's actually 4 days dead in the grave, Lazarus. And then Jesus turns up and both Mary and Martha's responses to him, Lord, if you'd only been here, things would have been different. But the whole purpose is that he was trying to show these people that there's something different about this man, Jesus. Not only is he who he claims to be, the Messiah, but that he could raise someone after 4 days dead, you know. And he responded to Mary and Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. And that was the whole purpose of that they would see that he's more than just a great teacher, more than just a great prophet, but he himself is the resurrection when it comes to life. So in this passage, you've got the greatest miracle. And in verse 24, then the woman said to Elijah, now by this I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. Of all the miracles that had happened to this woman, there was only one thing that really spoke to her. And it was actually resurrection. And when I thought about that, I thought, well, what about the bin, you know, the barrel that never exhausted itself and all of those types of things? Like, that speaks of God's continual provision. But resurrection is a whole nother level. When someone comes back from the dead, when new life is actually given. And I thought about that in our own lives, it's actually very true as well. You know, sometimes we see the unseen hand of God providing for us continually. But when you see new life come, that's something completely different. When someone is walking one direction and then they have an encounter with God and they are no longer the same. And they decide all their desires and all their things change. And they say, no, I'm going to go this way. Everything has become new. You know, that is the power of resurrection life, that somebody can actually change, just have new desires and a new will to follow God. And it's this thing here that spoke to this woman. She said, now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is the truth. So resurrection actually spoke to her the most. Yeah. So in this chapter 17, you've got three massive instances in the life of Elijah. And you've got to remember that God is, while he's hiding the prophet, because judgment is upon the land, he's also training and he's also teaching his servant. So in this passage, you've got three real major things that are coming upon him. He sends him to a place that a brook is going to dry up. And he has to learn that God has the right to order his steps. God has the right to send him where he wants. God is the one who is in charge of his provision. But also, he sent him to something that will dry up. God will continually move his people of God. He'll continually move them around. But Elijah himself may have felt like that dried up brook. And many of us do. We feel like dried up brooks. And it's really only the Spirit of God that can actually bring life to that situation. He then sent him to a woman that had an empty barrel. And I love that little part in this chapter 17 because it reminds me of the little that she was willing to give, God actually used. Just like Moses in the Old Testament. I was thinking this morning, it's just like Moses in the Old Testament when he was in the backside of the desert 40 years, never expecting God to show up, and then he turns up in a bush, you know. And that bush was consumed with fire, but the bush was not consumed. And it could have been any bush. And Maggie and Thomas talks a lot about this passage. It's not the bush that counts. It's the life inside. It doesn't matter what type of bush it is, but it's the life inside the bush that actually counts. And it's the same with this. It doesn't matter what type of barrel he uses. But that barrel first had to be made available to God. The woman was willing to give of the little. She was about to make her last meal before she died, but she was willing to give of that last thing, and then God actually used that barrel to actually provide. And it's like that. She had no ability to provide for others except really the provision of God. So in this last part, the dead boy. The dead boy speaks of resurrection life. That we, in and of ourselves, the Bible says that we're dead in our trespasses and sins, but God has made you alive in Christ Jesus. And it's that life, really, that can only bring life from death, the resurrection life. So even though, he gets sent to these different areas, God is continually training his servant, Elijah, for the things to come. So when you get to chapter 18, and we'll have a little look at this and we'll probably end through somewhere in here. We'll read the first few, maybe up to verse 16. We'll just have had a couple of thoughts in here because the scene changes. And it came to pass after many days, this is chapter 18, that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year saying, go present yourself to Ahab and I'll send rain on the earth. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab, and there was a severe famine in Samaria. And Ahab, who was called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for so it was while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them 50 to a cave and had fed them with bread and water. And Ahab had said to Obadiah, go into all the land, to all the springs of water and to all the brooks. Perhaps we might find grass to keep the horses and mules alive so that we will not have to kill any livestock. So they divided the land between them to explore it. Ahab went one way by himself and Obadiah went another way by himself. Now as Obadiah was on his way, suddenly Elijah met him and he recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is that you, my Lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go tell your master, Elijah is here." So he said, "How have I sinned that you are delivering your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to hunt for you." And when they said, "He is not here," he took an oath from the kingdom or nation that they could not find you. And now you say, "Go tell your master Elijah is here." And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone, that the Spirit of the Lord will carry you to a place I do not know. So when I go and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he will kill me. But I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. Was it not reported to my Lord what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord? How I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets, 50 to a cave, and fed them with bread and water. And now you say, "Go tell your master, Elijah is here, he will kill me." Then Elijah said, "As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely present myself to him today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. So after him hiding at this place of Zarephath, finally the word comes forward, "You've got to go, you've got to go back." And it's 3 and a half years. In the third year, James tells us that it was an exact period of 3 and a half before rain actually came. So he had to go and present himself to Ahab. In the meantime, you've got this character, Obadiah, who's an interesting character. His name means servant of God. And when I read through this passage, I thought you've got two very different servants of God in this passage. You've got Elijah who's bold, he's fearless. He's like someone who draws a line in the sand and says you're either on this side or the other. He's someone who calls for judgment. He's a man of no compromise. And his ministry was really to restore the people back to their true God, to restore the children back to the fathers. And then you've got Obadiah. When you read this passage, you see that first it says about him that he feared the Lord greatly and he was in charge of Ahab's house. But yet you've got a very different type of Christian. You've got someone who stays within the house. He's in Ahab and Jezebel's courts, but yet he works secretly. He's very quiet about his faith and probably doesn't have much influence over the courts of Ahab and Jezebel, but he works by stealth. He hides when he sees danger. He looks after Christians. And when I thought about these two, and when I read this passage, it's almost as though Elijah. My own thoughts is that Elijah actually doesn't think that much of Obadiah. Obadiah seems to say to him, "Look, was it not reported to my Lord what I did?" And you know, Elijah's asking him to do something. He's afraid of dying. He doesn't want to go and see Ahab because he's afraid that Ahab will kill him. So he's afraid that his life will be taken. He does things in secret. And I get the impression that Elijah, when you go on, Elijah, when he presents himself to Ahab, he says, "Look, I'm the only one." Obadiah tells him, "Look, I've already hidden all these prophets," but Elijah doesn't seem to recognize that. And he responds by saying, "Look, I'm the only one there actually is." He doesn't recognize Obadiah and he doesn't recognize all the other prophets that have been hidden. Even after all his failings coming on further in the book, when he gets right to the end, God says to him, "Well, what are you doing here, Elijah?" And he still responds, "Look, I'm the only one you've got." And God has to tell him, "Well, no, sorry, you're not. There's 7,000. People that have not kneeled to Baal that you actually don't know about." But Elijah doesn't seem to recognize that. And when I thought about that, I thought, When you think of the Elijahs of the world, they are very few and far between. If you look back over history, like John the Baptist was another Elijah. He drew a line in the sand and said, look, this is the way it is. Repent. You know, when you look back over history, who would be the Elijahs? Martin Luther? Martin Luther would be. Drew a line in the sand and said, look, the just have to live by faith, not by works. You know, you drew a line in the sand, you're either on this side or the other. Can anyone else think of others? Because they're actually very few. Yeah, when the Baptist Church was heading that way. Yeah. But there's few, not many. But most Christians, when I thought most Christians are actually probably Obadiahs. You know, they stay within the systems and do what they can for the people of God, but are normally quite suppressed. You know, like Obadiah was, to a degree. And normally the Elijahs don't actually recognize the Obadiahs. If you come across people that are Elijahs, they want people to come out. Come out and be separate. You know, that's their big thing. And they don't recognize those that actually stay within and work away. And I sort of see this in this passage. It does say that Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, and the Lord still used him because he still hid those that, and he still worked by stealth, you know, to actually look after God's people. But Elijah straight away is called to come and see this guy, and Obadiah is afraid for his life. So when they're going, he actually agrees in the end, and then. Yeah, we've got the next scene. Is there any other thoughts through the raising of the sun? I know we've raced through that Obadiah pretty quickly, but next time we'll go into actually Elijah confronting all the prophets, all the false prophets of Baal and what happens there. But is there any other thoughts in that